Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm with Gary Bain. I'm always with Gary Bain.
Is it Christmas?
No, it's not Christmas. That's another 3 weeks. But yes, that was 2 weeks ago. Yes, I'll be just taking these decorations down. So anyway, here we are at my gaff, looking at that plastic, that mighty oak of a tree. To 2 foot six plastic. And what we're doing today, because we've been doing the 16th Durham Light Infantry all through the Second World War. It's been, for me, our finest ever, our best ever series. Coincidentally, just at the time my book came out on, what was the book on? 16th DLI at War.
Foot Sluggers.
Yeah, I hope you've all bought that. Doesn't seem like you have.
Price is reduced at the moment on Amazon.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, was that not our book that was reduced?
And yours.
Yeah. Right, so what are we doing? Where are we up to in the story? I remember they were in Italy. They were going across valleys and rivers and hills and ridges. And where are they now? What's happening?
Well, there's a clue in the title, because today, Pete, it's the 16th DLI Grecian Odyssey.
Is that some sort of hair product? Grecian 2000. I don't need Grecian 2000. Do you know why?
Because you've got no hair.
That's right. Right.
Anyway, let's get back to the podcast.
Oh, then the first bit, let's not pretend we know out about the first bit, because we're going to set the background, aren't we?
Yeah, so this is in a not-so-far-away country, something was stirring. We're doing a lot of purple prose lately.
I do enjoy a bit of purple prose.
Now, the Greek People's Liberation Army,
oh!
That's like the People's Front of Judea.
It is. ELAS, I think we'll go for ELAS. ELAS, yeah.
That was the paramilitary body of the Communist-Controlled National Liberation Front, or EAM, EAM. And it had been at the very heart of resistance since the German invasion in April 1941.
Yeah, so you've got ELAS and EAM. They're the Greek Communist Party and other left-wing parties. Are they on their own? I think that would be unfair to say they're on their own.
No. I mean, it's a national struggle, and they were joined in that struggle by more moderate and non-political elements.
Yeah, we normally call these right-wingers.
Yeah, now resistance operations against the Germans began in June 1942, but were greatly boosted when officers of the British Special Operations Executive, or SOE, parachuted in.
Now, what is their role? What are they doing? Because there's not many of them, are there?
No, they were there to assist in attacks on rail routes, while at the same time promoting cooperation between ELAS and the right-wing National Republican Greek League, or EDES. Now, EDES was far more palatable to the British, but ELAS
tasted nicer.
Was the more popular and powerful grouping. And beggars cannot be choosers.
So the British were actively training ELAS and arranged for supplies to them. How would you say ELAS progressed during the years, well, say 42, 43?
Well, they grew in popularity, and their guerrilla bands had considerable success launching raids from their hiding places in the mountainous regions.
Now, there was it's becoming evident that the Allies are going to win the war. Now, as we all know, communists are peace-loving and never cause any trouble. How did the ELAS celebrate this this international brotherhood moment?
Well, they began an internecine warfare.
Wow! You said internecine, right.
With EDES, which simmered in the background throughout 1944. Now, by this time, ELAS numbered over 50,000 partisans, and in conjunction with EM...
That's the political wing, yeah.
As opposed to EDAM, which is a cheese, had the potential to create a Greek government capable of rivaling not only the puppet government set up by the Germans in Athens, but also the official government, which was in exile, residing in Cairo.
How many governments can one country have? Now, by this time, the British are more confident in victory, and so they're not beggars anymore. They can choose which side. So who do they choose?
Well, they give free rein to the government's preference of the monarchist elements within EDES, with the ultimate aim of returning the Greek government in exile, which was led by Prime Minister Georgios Papandreou, to Athens.
Right, so this is duly achieved. Papandreou arrives in Athens in October 44 and forms a government of national unity. He's accompanied by some Greek army units and British forces. Lovely British forces. Under the command of Lieutenant General Sir Ronald Scobie. How does it go at first? This reminds me a bit of Northern Ireland, this next bit. Carry on.
Yeah, well, that's because many of the ELAS forces still saw the British as liberators from the hated Germans. But this gratitude coexisted with a natural suspicion as to the motivations of the British Empire. I think we've heard that before.
I thought everybody loved the British Empire.
I think everybody's suspicious of their motivations. The French certainly were.
Would the words perfidious Albion spring to your mind?
No, because I wouldn't have ever thought of them. Now, a major trigger for the fighting that followed was Papandreou's orders for all partisan forces not under his command to completely disarm.
Now, I think this is unreasonable. ELAS naturally, and they rightly consider it would render them defenceless in what could be, for ELAS is a hostile world. So what do ELAS propose?
Well, they propose a compromise involving mutual disarmament by all partisan forces, which was rejected.
Now, I don't think that's wrong. Do you?
No, and I don't think that it should have necessarily not have been considered, but an ultimatum was issued that ELAS should disarm by the 10th of December.
So, this just so much reminds me of various things in our past. So write it on the wall. The EAM, that's the political wing of ELAS. You can look at it the other way. The other one's the military wing. But the ministers that are serving in Papandreou's National Unity Government promptly resign. Well, that'll help, won't you? So what happens then? What always happens when... I mean, you can see now this is going into something where there's going to be... Our reaction.
Going to be trouble.
Aye, at mill.
Aye. Now, this was followed by calls for a general strike and the organisation of a huge protest demonstration in Athens on the 3rd of December.
Now, this was big, at least 200,000, although we all know you can't count demonstrations, but 200,000 people were reputed to have attended, and they marched through the city, heading for the centre. And who gets in their way? Which mugs seem to get in the way of things?
It was impeded by British soldiers and tanks.
And again, this reminds me of Northern Ireland. What happens next?
Well, there's controversy over who fired the first shots. Many believe it was the work of the Greek police, many of whom had been collaborators with the Germans and thus had no love for ELAS. It's estimated that some 28 demonstrators were killed and hundreds injured.
Now, this is then seen that the ELAS, who... I'm struggling with some of this. They do turn into baddies, but at the moment I'm struggling with what's going on. They're portrayed fairly or unfairly, depending on your political perspective. And I think my political perspective, whatever it is, maybe peeping through at times, they're perceived as having launched a coup d'etat. Now, this is where the British can't let this go. Why not?
Well, they've got no intention of allowing a communist regime to be established in Greece. In essence, we can now see the conflict that followed as the first sort of proxy war of the Cold War.
Yeah. Now, British reinforcements had already been called for. And who were these masked men who were called for?
Well, some part of it was 139th Brigade, and they were one of the first. And the 16th DLI and the 2nd 5th Leicesters were both sent to Athens, while the 5th Foresters were dispatched to Salonika.
Now, the main body of Durham, so they fly out on Dakotas. Now, this is incredibly rare. Why is it rare?
I don't know.
The word fly. This is an air transport.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah. For the first,
it's first time for Durham. So they've always gone Sobieski, they've gone on boats.
Yeah.
You know, this is quite unusual. And they go to Athens. So, now, where they land at... where is it? Kalamaki Airport. And when do they land? 3rd of December. That's the
1944.
That's the day of the big demo. So it's the first time most of them had ever flown, because no one flew on their foreign holidays then, did they?
I was just going to point out the first time I flew was in 1979 when I flew to Germany.
First time I flew was about 1998. I thought airplanes were dangerous. I never understood how they stayed up in the air.
I still don't. Now, changing the subject back, as they arrived, George Bland seemed to have caught sight of one of the protests, which was, you pointed out, were happening that day. And this is Private George Bland of the Carrier Platoon Support Company. It was a Sunday morning and there were thousands of them coming along the coast road. They were chanting, a demonstration like. We had a bloke called Lieutenant General Scobie that was in charge, and they were coming along shouting. I was saying to myself, what are they saying? They were saying, Scobie is a bastard, Scobie is a bastard,
la 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 la.
Chanting like that. I think that the royalists that wanted the king back were in a minority. Or if they weren't, they didn't dare say anything.
Now, the 16th BLI, DLI, got my letters wrong. They were initially based at various police stations around Athens. It's a tense situation because of that outbreak of violence, the shooting on during that third of they're not involved in that. I want to make that clear. But the shooting did take place. And what's happening? What is overall happening? Again, echoes of Northern Ireland.
Well, it's sporadic fighting which is occurring between the Elas guerrillas and the Greek police. But at first, the British were mere bystanders.
They get dragged in, don't they?
They are. First, a few snapshots of
snipers,
them.
The odd, yeah.
Yeah, then a somewhat clumsy retaliation, more shooting until the situation spirals out of control. And one example of this was witnessed by Tony Sacco, and that signaller Tony Sacco of A Company.
We were going up the main street in Athens. There was a crowd of people there. We pulled up. Next thing I knew, Major Casey got out and demanded this gun from this chap. Give me that gun! This chap started to scream, and as soon as he started screaming, the whole crowd came round us. We just got round the corner, and there was this window up above, the first story. That window went up, and there's this man sitting with a great big old-type Vickers machine gun with a man at either side of him. He was screaming at us, and we were in the back of this truck only about 20 yards away. He had this gun on us. We were shouting, give him his pistol back! But Major Casey didn't want to lose face. Oh, dear. I thought, well, I'm not going to sit and take it. There's only four or five of us in the back of the truck. I got out of the back of that truck, three-tonner, in slow motion. No hasty moves. There was a yard with a gate recessed, and I got undercover, doing everything in slow motion. He's trying not to be threatening. In the end, I used some bad language to Major Casey. He gave him his pistol back. And the crowd started to cheer. And you could see that could have been a flashpoint. If anything had gone wrong, that machine gun could have opened up and they'd have been dead.
Yeah. Recognising that the overall situation was deteriorating, the British reorganised, pulling the 16th DLI back from Athens to join Block Force.
Oh, is that named after?
Well, it's named after Brigadier Alan Block in the Piraeus area. Alongside the 2nd... 5th Leicesters, a squadron of tanks and some RAF armoured cars.
Now, as the trucks drove down the narrow streets, they passed along one where the Elas and the Greek police are fighting. And all they could do is just accelerate and hope they got through. And they did. How did the Elas react as they whizzed past?
Well, it was a mixture of cheery waves and isolated shots.
Oh.
Hello. Bang. Now, many of the Durhams were still dubious about their role in this.
Why?
Well, they were aware that the ELAS had taken a major part in fighting the mutual enemy, the Germans, with all the painful sacrifices and losses that that entailed.
Well, now it seemed that the ELAS were the enemy. And do you know what? It didn't seem quite well to these lads. Remember, they're working class lads. And by this time, the British Army is pretty left wing. I mean, you know what happens in the election just 6 months later. And it's not helped by gangs of ELAS supporters. And they're shouting slogans which would appeal to many of them. What? Give me an example.
Liberty and justice. We want freedom. And that classic, down with the fascist Scobie. Now, Ronald Elliott was one of those that were concerned. And this is Private Ronald Elliott of A Company.
He's a signal. Yeah, that's right.
All of the army by that time was pretty well socialist. Everyone was of the view that the Conservatives were to blame for all sorts of ills that we had had in the war. The general level of the economy. Even though I think people admired Churchill for his ability to lead the country, his politics were completely suspect. He was conservative and was blackened with the rest of the Conservatives. We felt what the government was trying to do in Greece was to restore the monarchy, which we also surmised was really not what the people wanted, but it was just going to be imposed upon them. In the beginning, there was a fair amount of favourable feeling towards this insurgency.
Now, you might think, oh, well, what are they going to do about it? But although they're not regular soldiers, you know, they have had a lot of experience in the army this time. And they do what they're told to do. Because it's not told, is it?
No, and they have to, like all soldiers, put their personal inclinations to one side.
So they're ordered to do something. They've got to do it. And they do it. Now, where are they based? They're down by the port. Leicester's in Piraeus itself, while the Durhams take up defensive positions strung out along the seafront. And what was their job?
Well, their task was keeping open the coastal road, which stretched back to Athens. The first proper skirmish occurred when Lieutenant T.C. Perriam of C Company encountered a group of ELAS attempting to set up a roadblock.
Ah, well, that would stop the road, wouldn't it?
It would. So both sides opened fire and the obstruction was removed, with some casualties reported to have been inflicted, particularly on ELAS.
Yeah. The situation calms down for a couple of days, but there's quite a lot of ELAS sniping, and it's starting to be not so much fired in your general direction as hitting people.
Yeah.
And who's one of the first to die?
Well, it was a popular officer, Lieutenant Frank Johnson, who was shot on the 8th of December and died the next day. And this is one of our favourites. This is Lieutenant Russell Collins of Carrier Platoon. There were a few of us who were quite musical, and we used to sing in the mess in the evening just for fun. We used to sing in little quartets. Hymn tunes were about all we knew. Frank Johnson was one of four of us. Ronnie Sherlaw was another. Giff Footer, and myself. Poor old Frank went out to try and sort out somebody, and one of the ELAS snipers got him. A very dear friend indeed.
Yeah, never forgot him, because that, you know, he's an old man when he did that interview, and, you know. 9th of December, a local truce is established, and Alan Hay, Major Alan Hay and Sherlaw are part of this. And this is what, I think this is Alan Hay. I've got it down as Ronnie Sherlaw, but I actually think it's Alan Hay. I'll check that later, but it doesn't matter. It's an officer. He says this: I was lucky in recruiting a girl who had excellent English. She put me in touch with the chap who was the leader of the ELAS in that area. He said that if we would agree not to shoot at them, he would agree not to shoot at us for a period of a week when we could perhaps come to some terms. I said I wasn't in a position to do that sort of thing, but I would have a word with the colonel. The colonel agreed that we should have a local armistice. Every morning for about 3 days, I'd start at this bottom end of Fallerin. I would take out my pistol and put it on the ground. The ELAS leader, he would put his gun down, and we'd walk up and shake hands. We had about 3 days of peace. Then on the third night, the ELAS broke the peace and attacked one of my platoon, and in fact killed somebody. So that ended the peace. We were very fed up about it. I'm not surprised. You can see dislikes starting to creep in, but from both sides.
Yeah, and just think about that. That was the 9th of December. Frank wouldn't have died, perhaps, if it was during that three-day peace. Yeah. It's just fate, really, isn't it?
It is.
Now, the breakdown of the truth was preceded by intelligence that ELAS were planning an imminent attack. On the 13th of December, full-blown hostilities recommenced. Firstly, during the day, a couple of Bren carriers were shot up, causing three casualties.
But that's not the real attack. That's going to happen at night. And the army, they're watching out. They can see movements in the surrounding streets. They can tell that the attack was due. And most of the battalion went on to high alert, standing to, ready for immediate action. Was that everybody?
Well, there seems to have sadly been one platoon that was accepted in B Company, and Private James Corr of B Company tells us the story.
One night, the sergeant major came to us. He said, "Right, you are. We're going out to Lieutenant Whitwell's billet. I've heard word there's going to be an attack, and I want to warn him." By this time, it was about 10:30 at night, so it was dark. We went in front of our barrier, very careful, to go to his house. They were to the left of us, about 50 yards in front of the barrier, in a little side street. The first house on the right was a big house, and they were all in there. We go in, and all we could hear was the piano playing and drunken singing. I'll never forget the song this lad was singing. "If I had a paper doll to call my own." Sounds like a classic. The sergeant major bustled his way in, and there was the lieutenant, as drunk as a kitty cat. Honestly, he was. He was paralytic. They got some vino, and they were all drunk. No guards on the door. The sergeant major tried to get some sense into them, but he couldn't, and at the finish, the lieutenant ordered him away. He came back and he said, "Well, I've done my best." We manned the barriers all night, and sure enough, there was an attack, and the house he was in was... Lieutenant Whitwell, it was blown up. The lieutenant got taken prisoner with a full platoon in the house, all drunk. Now this is interesting because that's oral history. And how is this reported in the 16th DLI war diary and in the subsequent battalion history by Laurie Stringer?
Well, here there's a heroic tale of a desperate fight against a ferocious mob who were held at bay until the defenders had run out of ammunition, at which point ELAS managed to place an explosive charge against the front door, blowing it open and then rushing the building.
Which do you believe?
The war diary, obviously.
Innocent Gary, they used to call you, didn't they?
Yeah, amongst other things.
Now, the most serious attack came on the 13th of December. It wasn't there, really. It was made on the battalion headquarters at about 1400. Now, Colonel Dennis Worrell, he was briefly away. So who's in charge?
Well, it's Major J.C. Denny.
We've not heard much about him, have we?
No, while Major Alan Hay was temporarily standing in as second in command.
That's why I think it was him in that previous quote.
And this is Major Alan Hay of the headquarters company.
We then came under very heavy attack. These people were shouting. It was just a rabble. I put what men I could find in open positions. We were firing from the windows, but we were getting casualties. So we got up onto the flat roof because there was a little more protection. There was this parapet you could keep behind. So unless they had mortars, they couldn't catch us. We could hear them hammering and knocking. There were so many, and we really couldn't disperse them because the angles for rifle fire from the top were really too acute, and they were down underneath. But I had four grenades, so I had to wait until enough of these ELAS guerrillas came into view before I hurled a grenade. They didn't charge, but they were creeping forward when they thought our firing had died down because we didn't have much to fire at them. We didn't know how many at that time, but there was an awful lot, hundreds. They were all raging and shouting, a real mob. They were going to drive us into the sea. I waited and waited and then threw another grenade. These people were screaming and shouting. They were going to blow us up. There was this hammering going on down below. Then an explosion went off. The whole of the outside of the flats collapsed just like a cardboard box. The outer floors collapsed. We were a bit further back. I was stunned by some masonry. I can't have had my tin hat on because I had a gash across my head. Then they charged, but they were just making a noise. I don't think they were effective in anything. White flags appeared shortly from the mob and they wanted to collect their wounded. By this time it was getting towards morning. They came with barrows and bits of sheet with red crosses painted on them to get their dead and wounded. I would think that casualties there could have been about 100. We didn't have any casualties except the Sergeant Cook and some others who were buried in the rubble and we had to get them out. They were all right. They had cuts and bruises. I think I was the worst with a gash across the top of my head. And, you know, again, you get an idea. I don't believe it was 100 dead or dead and wounded, but you could see the balance of the casualties would be definitely in favour of the Durhams that day.
Yeah, and daylight brought a sort of relative calm, but it had certainly been a night to remember. It was also evident that Elas must have suffered severe casualties, with subsequent reports of 36 dead and 60 wounded. Shortly afterwards, Dennis Worrell returned, and Alan Hay was posted to command A Company.
And I think at this point we'll take a short break to just consider our role within society.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
By this time, the Durhams had become cynical as to the nature of the insurgency tactics practiced by the Elas guerrillas, who had been used to fighting an enemy, the Germans, who did not acknowledge any rules of warfare in dealing with civilians.
Now, what does that mean in practice?
Well, they'd learnt to seek any advantage they could in conflict situations. Now, that led to them adopting many methods which, to the British eyes, were cowardly.
And again, are you getting echoes of Northern Ireland here? I know, I mean, I shouldn't say echoes, because, of course, Northern Ireland hasn't happened. But you can see, and this is what Private Ronald Elliot, remember, he was not very, but he was pro-Elas at the start. What does he say?
The Elas tended to use women. They would have women coming along the street, just as though they were housewives having a demonstration, followed by armed men behind, using the women as a shield, or even having children around so you couldn't fire at them. It got very dirty in that sense. As will always happen in these situations, the soldiers' attitude changed from being politically favourable to being militarily against them, because they weren't playing particularly fair. Before very long, it was just that they were them and we were us. It was just a combat situation.
I mean, one of the biggest things is it's really difficult to tell who their enemies are. One Greek looks pretty much like another to their eye. If you're looking at them, you can't say, oh, that Greek's an Elas. And did the Elas wear uniform?
Well,
never.
Very few.
All right, very few. Now, this is, again, Private Ronald Elliot. We're charting this man's disillusion with his political principles here.
There was always this problem of knowing who they were. If someone shot at you, you shot back at him. Although people were quite glad to be away from the main battlefront, and certainly it wasn't as hard as fighting the Germans. There were aspects of it that people felt uneasy about. Your average infantryman, one of the first questions that you ask when you're going to a new battle position is, which way is the front? So that you know, if the worst comes to the worst, which way you can go to get out to the bloody place. Now, in this sort of urban battlefront, it's all around you. And one feels somewhat unhappy about that, because there's no clear-cut way out. Fighting amongst houses was not really the sort of warfare that we've been used to.
When you were in the army and in a German bar, beer keller, would you always want to know the way out?
I'd always want to know where the toilet was, frankly.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in these circumstances, there was a natural fear of mistakes and killing innocent civilians. But they were also aware that any hesitation could lead to their own deaths or capture.
And this is a telling quote from Corporal Tommy Chadwick of C Company. "We tried to avoid real civilians, but people don't pay a lot of attention to that. I've got to be truthful. I mean, you wouldn't deliberately shoot a civilian, but if there's any doubt in your mind, then it's better to be safe than sorry, and you'd let fly." And I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult period for the Durhams. However, reinforcements in the shape of elements from the 4th Indian Division were beginning to arrive to tip the balance in favour of the British.
And then on 15th of December, Lieutenant General Sir John Hawksworth, we remember him, their old divisional commander in 46th Division, arrives to take over command of all the British forces in Greece. So what happens next?
On the 18th of December, the 16th DLI began clearing the streets and houses in front of them, slowly edging their way forwards day by day towards the main railway line to Athens. Now, this was a difficult business in the narrow streets.
However, the next quote is ludicrous, isn't it? This is it. Why do I like this quote?
Well, it's because Chadwick, Corporal Chadwick, watched with some amusement when the august figure of Company Sergeant Major Les Thornton launched a one-man offensive.
Now, why would he have done that? Well, this is what Tommy Chadwick says. "One night, I saw Les was a bit tipsy, for want of another word. He decided to go and settle the war himself. So he ups and waltzes down this street, firing at everything he saw. Some of these ELAS chaps were on the rooftops, firing from behind chimney pots. How he wasn't shot that night, I will never know. He was fated. He ultimately came back, and Major Casey was waiting for him. He said, 'I want you.' Les said, 'I've been carrying out my duties, sir. A one-man firing patrol. Oh, I've nothing to report, sir.'" Although I suspect he slurred his words.
But it could be a deadly serious business. An ELAS sniper could lurk anywhere, and they weren't all bad shots. On the 24th of December, William Cowens witnessed a small tragedy, and this is Sergeant William Cowens of C Company. "One afternoon, we were trying to clear this house, and I lost two chaps killed. We encountered a sniper. He had a flat roof hiding place. We were in gardens about 50 yards away. I told Lance Corporal O'Brien to keep his section down in the garden next door. I came to the other side and I told Lance Sergeant Phillipson to keep his men down. I was in the middle garden, but half an hour after, one of the Lance Corporals came back and said Lance Corporal O'Brien had been shot through the head. He got up to talk to one of the lads, and the snipers had shot him through the head. I crept through next door, and there he was, poor devil. Somebody had put a cape over the top of him. He was a nice lad. About an hour after, another young lad called Chuck Harvey got shot through the head. He was the life and soul of the company. He got up to creep a bit further. He'd just got up too far, and the sniper must have been waiting for him. Just the one man it was, but he'd taken two lives."
All these losses, any individual loss is painful, isn't it? But the battalion does manage to establish a firm line running along buildings that stretch along the railway line. And what did they do as each new area of housing's cleared?
Well, they wire it off each night and they patrol it to prevent ELAS infiltration.
So stop them coming back.
The battalion was also engaged in some hearts and minds operations as they cleared the streets of the insurgents. Food and medical supplies were sent up to be distributed among the Greek civilians. And this is as Colonel Worrell later wrote in his report. "Lessons learned from recent fighting. The soup kitchen may be a better weapon than the rifle. A great interest should be taken in the distribution of food."
And it's interesting that A lot of the men say that once the ELAS guerrillas had been ejected from an area, the local population were a lot more friendly and welcoming. On the other hand, I just want to point out, that, and they take it as that ELAS weren't popular at all, but also the point is that that's the British were there now, and they're not going to carry, you know, they're going to be careful about how they speak. We sometimes forget that we know we're lovable British soldiers, but the other side, the, you know, local civilian populations don't always know it, do they?
No. Now, by this time, the bulk of 4th Division had arrived, which accelerated the process of taking control of Athens. On 3rd of January, the Durhams began operations in an industrial area on the outskirts of Athens. An attack was launched on a former Red Cross supply depot in an old factory held by ELAS. It was a substantial building, about a quarter of a mile square, with a wall round it. Wow, that is big. The operation didn't begin well for Les Thornton, and you're going to tell us what Company Sergeant Major Leslie Thornton of C Company said.
I presume he was sober on this occasion. He says this: intelligence had been reported that about 60 of these ruffians were holed up in a factory area on the outskirts of Athens. We were ordered to go and sort them out. We had to attack before light, but unfortunately, the lads had been doing a bit of drinking the night before, and when I got up, expected to see the sergeants and men ready to move, there was nobody there. They'd slept in. The major was going off his head, and he said, "We'll never get there now before light." We got them ready in double quick time, and off we set with our interpreter, a Greek interpreter, a student type of a lad. He was frightened to death. We were dodging along paths and hedgerows, and it started to get light. Now, in front of the factory, there was a great big open space. There was no cover at all. That's the reason we were supposed to have got there before light. We carried on and got to the factory wall. The major went in, and fortunately, they'd done the same as we had. They'd slept in. I was following the major, and suddenly I was fired on by a machine gun with my two lads, and we had to dodge behind a column in the wall. We stayed there. We couldn't get out. The firing came from a very high tower in the factory. I said, "This is no good." I bet he didn't. I bet he added some words. I took a running dive through the hole in the wall where we got through, dashed up the side of the road behind the wall, got a tank commander and said, you just see him off, will you?" He put a round in his gun and blasted that chap up there. That was the end of him. We got them all out. Some of them had been shot. A sorry lot of dirty people, bearded, one with his jaw shattered with a bullet. We loaded them up into trucks ready for interrogation. Wow.
Now, Les Thornton and his men were ordered further up the road to take another factory premise. Now, again, there was opposition that could have been dangerous, and Company Sergeant Major Leslie Thornton goes on.
We were fired on. The bullets were coming straight down the road. We had to get to this factory across the road, so we had to jump across two at a time. As soon as there was a lull in the firing, where we thought the chap was changing his magazine, then I would send two men across. Now, there was this man is interested in alcohol. Now, there's this cognac. I can't say that. Yes, I can. Cognac. Yeah. Factory with two great big doors. I was organising something, and one of the young officers, he really loves young officers, got hold of my Piat man and said, "Fire your Piat and burst those doors open." He was inexperienced about Piats. That's what does Piat stand for,
oh,
Gary?
I don't know.
Personal Infantry Anti-Tank Weapon. I've no idea, I'm guessing. You were supposed to be undercover and fire a Piat because it has a terrible blast, a blowback. He fired this Piat at the doors. It hit the doors and finished up in hospital because he got the backlash. I had to tell the young officer a couple of home truths about the use of a Piat. That it was dangerous if not handled properly.
Now, when they got inside...
Did you used to like young officers when you were in the army?
I still do. Now, when they got inside, they found something of great interest. You're doing all the work.
Can't possibly be me again.
Once more, you're going to tell us what Corporal Tommy Chadwick said.
We took a factory that had barrels of booze. We ran in and we were squirting the barrels with Sten gun fire. Of course, the stuff was pouring out all over the place, so we were filling water bottles with it. Within half an hour, we had about six men unconscious, so that put the mockers on it. What a great expression, put the mockers on it. But we kept our water bottles. Word got back to Major Casey, and he banned it. All the drink we had in our water bottles was to be put in jerry cans and kept till the end of the war. Yeah, there's a bit of an after thing. What happened to that spirit?
Well, later they found the raw spirit had burned its way through the jerry cans.
What do you think it was doing to their stomachs?
Yeah, exactly. Now, ELAS resistance collapsed in Athens, and the Durhams were optimistically hoping for a rest period. But the existence of several other pockets of ELAS resistance meant that their services were still required.
Yeah.
Now, on the 7th of January, they were dispatched at short notice to deal with an ELAS group based around Patras on the Peloponnese Peninsula. Now, the road route was impassable as the guerrillas had blown up the bridge over the Corinth Canal.
Naughty old guerrillas.
And they still controlled much of the route.
Now, that meant that the 16th ELI and the 2nd 5th Leicesters once more took to the high seas. And most of them were wondering what was going to happen when they arrived at Patras because they were just on a boat. Brigadier Alan Brock, he's got a cunning plan. And you're going to tell us from the perspective of Lieutenant Russell Collins' carrier platoon what that plan was.
The big question was what we were going to do because ELAS were in occupation. We'd arrived there in numbers, but we weren't deployed militarily. They weren't assault craft, just a cargo boat. We're all in there like so much luggage. When we arrived there, our brigadier brought off a tremendous psychological coup. Brigadier Block, who was a terrific man, went ashore, called for the local commander and issued an ultimatum that if they weren't out of the town of Patras by first light the next morning, they would have all hell knocked out of them by this great army of troops that were in these ships. He bluffed these chaps into getting out of Patras completely. So we just disembarked in a complete non-tactical way. We would have been helpless if they'd jolly well opened fire on us.
Yeah, that reminds you of Gallipoli, where remember they loaded everything wrong and had to go to Alexandria to sort themselves out. Now, things seem to be reminding me of other things today. Now, minimal resistance. And next day, a general truce is announced with ELAS across the whole of Greece. So it's lucky they didn't have a load of casualties landing because this war was over. So what does ELAS do?
They withdraw back into agreed areas. Now, with peace established, the 16th ELI returned to Patras, where they stayed for a month.
Yeah, they'd gone through. Sorry, I should have made that clear. They'd gone through Patras and started clearing the local countryside. That was unclear. Sorry, Gary, I've let you down, I've let myself down, and most of all, I've let the listeners down.
Now, patrols and detachments were sent out to various locations in the peninsula and the mountainous regions, but there was no trouble as the truce held.
Now, there's now a complete change of emphasis. So they've gone from a situation where everybody seems to be at risk all the time from a faceless enemy. You're a faceless enemy. To a more relaxed existence, far more relaxed existence. So what do you think the average soldier starts to think about?
Well, I think it's fair to say that drink and women were both of considerable interest to them.
Were they of interest to you when you were a young soldier?
No. And this is Private Ronald Elliot.
No, they were an obsession, weren't they?
This is Private Ronald Elliot of A Company. The cafes were open and everything, and the brothel was there. There was a way to the brothel, which was over the roofs of the outhouses to this factory and then into the brothel. The girls used to be at the main windows of the brothel, which faced the factory windows. They were more or less face to face across an intervening distance of about 50 yards. The girls would be there with nothing on, just enticing the soldiery with ribald remarks. You couldn't go in the front because there were people guarding it. I never did. But one or two of the lads reckoned that there was a route over the outhouse rooftop so that you could get into the brothel by the back door. This route lay beneath the window of the officer's mess, and this fella came back one night absolutely steaming and wet. When he'd been going past the officer's mess, one of the officers had pissed all over him from the window.
Well, it's nice to think that the Durham's officers are of such a social cachet that they piss out the window.
And have you noticed, whenever anybody is talking about a brothel, they always say, oh, I didn't go in.
But some of the lads
But somebody
did.
Told me.
Now, there's an essential truism that does not apply to you. The essential truism was that, what is it? Go on, what is the truism? And tell me why it doesn't apply to you.
Well, no, this is Major Arthur Vizard, and we'll let him tell
now
us.
Now I want you to tell me. What is the truism?
I don't know.
Some of the best soldiers, the troublemakers.
Are the best soldiers, yes.
Well, you were a troublemaker.
And it didn't apply to me. You're going to tell us what Major Arthur Vizard, having ruined the quote, said.
My chaps used to come back and they were the worst for wear, and the provost used to throw them in the truck and bring them back to the guard room. Next day they used to come in front of me, and I nearly always found that the fellows who were the biggest offenders were the best soldiers.
Yeah.
Done wrong again.
Now, meanwhile, the arrival of the rest of 46th Division was due, and advance parties were received from the 38th Brigade.
Yeah, they take over Patras, don't they? Yeah. That whole area.
Now, on the 11th of February, the 16th DLI returned to Athens to be based in Old Phaleron, where they soon settled in. Now, Arthur Vizard was really proud, if a little bit bemused, by the sheer malleability of his men to new circumstances. Now, we could hear from Major Arthur Vizard, or you could just ask me.
Yeah, I want to ask you.
No, this is what Major Arthur Vizard of Headquarters Company says.
Looking back at all this, the one thing that sticks out in my mind is the adaptability of the British soldier. You can pick him up and put him down into a totally unfamiliar, alien atmosphere where he doesn't understand what people are talking about. He's highly suspicious of all the people around him. And they're hostile, or they're friendly, or they're in between. But within the space of at the most 48 hours, he will have completely adapted himself to the new surroundings, like a chameleon. Before you know where you are, chickens appear. Eggs, tomatoes, melons and so forth. Washing is being done by Greek women. The men are talking to them. How they do it, I don't know. But there is this tremendous ability to adapt. Were you able to adapt to foreign circumstances?
I was very adaptive. Now, in Athens, the 16th DLI began to recommence proper military training with special company camps organised where there was weapons training, field firing and tactical exercises.
Now, that always worries people a bit when they have to start military training again. So what might be going through their mind? Well, what's going through their mind is what's going to happen next.
Yeah, what new battles might lie ahead of them?
Yeah, the Greek campaign's finished, so what the bloody hell's going on now? And soldiers, they're not human. If do you think they wanted to go into action?
No, they want to avoid going into action again. And this is Lieutenant Russell Collins of Courier Platoon. All the talk and speculation was, where are we going next? We were hoping against hope that we were going to be selected to go to Northwest Europe to join the much more glamorous party that was going on there. We abhorred the thought of going back to Italy again, where we'd fought two previous campaigns and had left a lot of our dead. We envied the chaps that had all the glamour. In any case, it would mean going home first. It seemed to be a very much more straightforward show there altogether. But in the event, we were told we were going back to Italy. Everybody was depressed about it. It didn't do much to improve morale.
And yeah, and he was a very brave and courageous soldier. Do you think they had a choice?
No, they're in the army. There's no choice, no freedom of action. What you're told and you go where you're told to go.
So off they go back to Italy. And we'll pick up on the story of what happens there in the next thrilling episode of the 16th DLI at War. Foot Sloggers.
With the Coughing Historian.
You'll be in your coffin soon.
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers, Gary. Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?